My name is John Worsencroft, and I'm sitting down with John Reed. It is Monday, November 2nd, and it's about 9:45 in the morning. John Reed is a lieutenant colonel in the Army, and he is also an adjunct professor at the University of Utah. John, is that information I just said correct?
I am retired.
Oh, back from the Army.
Yes.
Okay. Well, John, why don't you go ahead and give me a brief biographical, where you were born, when you were born, that kind of stuff, and we'll go from there.
I was born 25 August 1951 in San Antonio, Texas. I was the only child of John A. and Ann C. Reed. My father was born in 1918, and he fought in the Second World War in Northwest Europe as a rifle platoon leader in what we would today call a mechanized infantry unit. Back then they called it armored infantry. He was in combat for about 9 months and came home. My mother was one of three daughters of a pretty successful certified public accountant in Columbus, Georgia. That's where they met, at the infantry school. My dad was an OCS instructor before he was drug kicking and screaming out of the infantry school to be a replacement officer in the fall of, I guess it would have been the spring of 1944. They were married right after the war. My dad did not get a GI Bill bachelor's degree. He went right back to work for the corporation that he'd worked for before the war, Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing Company. My dad was kind of a hail fellow, big, good-looking guy, never met a stranger. So he was a salesman for his entire work life. I grew up in San Antonio, Texas, St. Louis, Missouri, Cincinnati, Ohio, and La Jolla, California. I went to college at President Obama's alma mater, Occidental College, for 4 years. That, of course, was the late 60s. I matriculated there in the fall of 69. I immediately grew my hair out to my shoulders and attended every single peace march I possibly could. So I was a lower rung anti-war radical and organizer. And a couple things happened. That was very late in the Vietnam War. Nixon's getting elected, Vietnamization, and the so-called Nixon lottery kicked in. I was subject to the second lottery, I believe, in the summer of 1970 or perhaps 71. I think 70. Mm-hmm. I drew an exceptionally high draft number, 364. In that year, they only went up, I think, to 118. So as soon as I drew that number, I understood that I was not going to have to serve in the Vietnam-era military, and I did not. The question then arises, why do I join the Army when I'm 30? Well, there's kind of a story about that. It's not a very, doesn't reflect a lot of credit upon me, as they would have said in Edwardian England. December of 1972 was the so-called Christmas bombing of Hanoi and Haiphong. President Nixon was trying to drag the North Vietnamese to a... to be willing to sign a document which would get the prisoners of war home and would allow Nixon to claim that American involvement in the war was over.
Right.
As part of that, there were a lot of B-52 missions flown in tight to population centers, and that was enormously unpopular among, radical punks like myself.
Right.
And I stayed with my friends throughout most of the Christmas break in 72, and we would watch the 6 p.m. news, and we would cheer. We were usually drunk. We would cheer at the news that this or that number of B-52 bombers had been shot down by Soviet, manufactured SA-2 missiles. And so this was sort of like the high point of my, youthful disillusionment with America and American culture. I graduate in May of 73, and I'm plopped into the belly of the Nixon recession, oil crisis recession. The only job I can get is a job as a entry-level professional in a social service organization in California, the Employment Development Department. It's a state bureaucracy. Almost immediately, I began meeting lots and lots of Vietnam veterans. And eventually, I had a strange job in which I would go to different towns in California, and I would meet up with 20 or 25 Vietnam-era vets who were being given shake and bake or super quick professional training in order to reach out to other Vietnam-era vets and to help provide them services. I mean, apparently, the social science data at the time indicated that a lot of vets would simply not attempt to secure the benefits if they had to deal with some little old blue-haired lady or some, you know, punk kid. So I would go out at night with these guys, and, you know, they'd drag me out to burlesque shows and stuff and get me drunk. And I began to get the idea that somehow I had exploited my class position, you know, by not serving. You know, I could conceivably have been on a fire base in Vietnam by the summer of 1970, and there were plenty of chances to get hurt after that still. I had a friend who joined the Army right after graduating. I lost contact with him, but that was sort of also floating around in my mind. So after about 7 years in this job, right around 1980, 81, I started thinking, well, heck, I needed to have some sort of military experience. I didn't have any pacifistic beliefs. The Vietnam War was over, and as it turned out, we weren't going to have another Vietnam for about a generation. And so my father fought in World War II, and I had a lot of respect for military virtues. And so I thought, well, I better get my butt in gear because I'm no kid any longer. I'm 30. What are my options? And so I flailed around and looked at a bunch of different things. I'll never know if I was serious enough to simply join as an enlisted soldier because I didn't have to do that. I ended up getting a direct commission in the Army Reserve from civilian life with no prior military experience. This was a period in which the reserves were having a very hard time filling slots because of the unpopularity of military service, and reserve service was no longer a way of avoiding the draft, if it ever truly was one. So I get a direct commission, strangely enough, into the infantry branch, which was a very risky thing for them to do. I began drilling in a civil affairs unit in Santa Barbara, California. And then that began a period of about 20 or so years as a drilling reservist, weekend warrior, you know, doing the weekend drills once a month, 2 weeks plus in the summer, Tuesday nights for free. And the first 6 years, from 82 until about 88, there was a lot of money. That was the Reagan era. A lot of money was flowing into the reserves. And so I did a number of tours of 6 months, 4 months duration, sort of trying to beef myself up so I knew more about the Army, to sort of catch up to where I thought I would have been if I'd been an ROTC guy who'd, you know, done summer camps and stuff. Mm-hmm. So 1988 rolls around, and I'm also flailing around trying to figure out what I'm doing with my life as a civilian. I begin a PhD program in the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. At roughly the same time, I met my wife, Hema Guevara, so at that point, I had sort of a two-track life in which I was getting my PhD. That took me 7 years. And also, I was attempting to have a reserve career that I was meeting all the expectations, but also squeezing that for as many bucks as I could, because I obviously wasn't making much money as a graduate student.
Right.
So that lasts from 88 until about 95, and my wife was very, very disturbed by the first Gulf War. She was politically very much against it, and she did not believe that I was relatively unlikely to be called. At that time, as I recall, the Army was taking reserve units mm-hmm. with their personnel that would fit into the deployment plan and sending them. I don't remember ever meeting a person who was taken as an individual filler.